Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCrit Podcast. Today, another iteration of the Acid Base series. We got some stuff to talk about. The first thing we will talk about is the Bicar ICU trial, and then we'll talk about a dual set of posts by reigning foam physio king John Emil Kenny, knocking the Stewart approach to acid base interpretation. But let's deal with the first thing first. Now, there's already been some great coverage of the Bicar ICU trial. You'll find it on the PulmCrit site on MCrit. Josh just put up a post yesterday. It's amazingly good, so check that out. And then the bottom line folks and all sorts of people around the foam universe have put stuff up on this. I just wanted to give you my take on it. I thought this was a great trial. The primary outcome was negative, and Josh has all sorts of reasons why that was pretty much inevitably going to be the case. The most interesting part of the trial for me was the fact that one of the secondary endpoints, patients who were critically ill with renal failure, actually seemed to benefit from a bicarbonate infusion. I think for me, this might actually be a practice-changing study because I was right on the verge. And in fact, I listened back to my two bicarbonate episodes to make sure I'm not contradicting anything I've said in the past, and I am not. I've pretty strongly knocked the use of bicarbonate pushes, you know, slam in an amp of 8.4% over 60 seconds routinely. And so I look back on those episodes, and I think this fits in with my prior thought with the one difference that this will now push me, I think, to giving bicarbonate infusions for patients who have anion gap metabolic acidosis or SIG acidosis, in addition to the non-anion gap acidosis I've always done in the past in patients with renal failure or impending renal failure. I got an email from one of the listeners, Keith Coral. He did some great work on the IVC and spontaneous breathing patients as well. That's where you might have heard him mention. And he actually wrote to the lead author of the study, who I'm going to pronounce it Jabber. I hope that's not a mispronunciation. Asking about these exact patients and saying how many of them were non-anion gap and how many of them were anion gap acidosis. And the interesting response was, since this was an equipoise study, pretty much none of the patients in the study were purely non-anion gap acidosis patients because those patients were considered standard of care to receive bicarbonate and never would have been enrolled. So pretty much all of the ones who had benefit in the treatment group were patients who had anion gap acidosis or lactic acidosis. That is interesting to me. Now, Josh goes into all the stuff about the actual bicarb chosen. I mean, how that was mixed up, that it was 4.2%. And, you know, Josh talks about giving this as a, you push the bicarb and give D5 at the same time. I think that's not the way I would ever do this. What I would do is I would take a 50cc bag of D5W and add to it the amp of sodium bicarbonate. And that gets you the 4.2% and allows you to drip it in so that you're not flushing in a huge amount of CO2 by pushing an amp of bicarb. And so that's how I'd make this happen. And the interesting thing is, you know, this endpoint was primarily dealing with the need for dialysis. But one of the indications in the study for dialysis was acidosis. And this gets back to a, I think, fundamental question, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it, which is, what level of acidosis really gets you worried, certainly worried enough to prescribe dialysis for no other reason? Now, for me, I get worried when they're less than 7. This trial was saying if you are less than 7.2, that's an indication for dialysis, along with one of the following, either low urine output or hyper-K. That means that, of course, there's going to be less dialysis in the bicarbonate group, because the interesting thing about this trial was that they only enrolled patients whose CO2 was not high. So therefore, bicarb will certainly work to raise their pH, and therefore, they will avoid dialysis from the perspective of acidosis, and therefore, they will get less dialysis. It's automatic. And the question is, if dialysis that's unnecessary is actually harm-inducing, and I think it very well might be, all of the experience with putting blood through extracorporeal circuits when unnecessary seems like a very bad thing, then it would lead to a better outcome in the bicarbonate group. They've avoided dialysis because the indication in this study for dialysis was acidosis. Their acidosis got better, and therefore they avoided dialysis, and therefore they did better overall. The question I would be left with is, does a patient need dialysis purely for acidosis? I'm not sure they do. But if in your unit you are dialyzing patients purely based on that, then this is probably an intervention you should try first, because avoiding dialysis is probably beneficial. So this is all in service of saying, I'm probably going to give my critically ill patients with renal failure bicarb infusions to get their pH up a little bit after this trial. Curious to hear what you think. Check out the other links on the web, and I think we could leave that there. Let's get into the second part of this episode, which is John Emile Kenny, who's been writing amazingly well-crafted physio posts over on the Palm CCM site, put up one on the death in his mind of the Stewart approach. And I read both of these and I said, wow, this is very erudite stuff that I can completely not understand. I was not a science person in undergrad. I had to teach myself all of the sciences necessary to be a physician. And that extended to the clinically relevant sciences. I never went to what I would consider non-clinically relevant physical chemistry. So I can't understand this. I needed someone smarter than me to interpret this. So I called up David Story, critical care doctor, acid-base guru, professor of anesthesia and critical care at the University of Melbourne. We start talking about the John Emile Kenny post, and then we go into a little more about acid-base that I hope you'll find interesting.
So if we look at Dr. Kenny's post, it raises the issues of the underlying physical chemistry and the Stewart approach to acid-base disorders. My view of the Stewart approach is very much at the macro level, at the plasma or patient level. I mean, a lot of the debate is actually more what Dr. Kenny also calls the micro level, the true physical chemistry level. And so I'm not a physical chemist, and I cannot adequately comment on the methodology used, the underlying physical chemistry of this micro discussion, particularly things, you know, this fundamental issue about water dissociation and is it or is it not the source of hydrogen ions, which is really one of the fundamental issues in the Stewart approach. I think far more constructive for your readers and listeners is to take the macro view. How does Stewart help the critical care community in particular deal with acid-base disorders? Nephrology friends are also using it, but they seem particularly beholden to the bicarbonate-based approach. And I have inadvertently in the past upset a number of them by making fairly outrageous Australian-type comments about people who follow the bicarbonate-based approaches. Having said that, I am in fact an agnostic. If someone said to me, look, here is definitive proof that the bicarbonate-based approach is in fact the way to go, I would accept that. But I think there are a number of things that don't come up in the when one looks at Stewart or when people have looked at Stewart. If we go back to Dr. Kenny's paper, particularly the first part, where he was discussing, you know, the cellular-based formation of lactate and does that produce acidosis. And he correctly said that when one uses the Stewart approach, it's got to be all the way to the bottom. That is, you've got to go right down to the cellular fundamental chemistry. One of the fundamental principles of the Stewart approach is you've got to consider the three main variables, the partial pressure of carbon dioxide, the difference in the strong ions, and the total amount of weak acids when one considers, you know, as a snapshot, the acid-base status of a particular bodily fluid. In plasma, this is relatively straightforward. Intracellularly, this is, you know, incredibly difficult and will vary enormously between cells. And Dr. Kenny correctly identifies that you would need to analyze all the weak acids, all the strong ions, and the partial pressure of carbon dioxide to conclude what is actually happening inside a cell. And this is currently almost impossible to do. Whether that is an argument for or against Stewart, I think we'd have to sit in the neutral position to say, look, you could argue either way. So if we look more at a macro view and look at, I think one of the things that a lot of people miss, because they say, oh, Stewart's complex and everything else, I don't think it needs to be complex. But what I see is particularly attractive about Stewart is it integrates standard plasma chemistry, everyday plasma chemistry, with acid base. So it is, in fact, a unifying theory of plasma, particularly plasma chemistry, but the chemistry of any bodily fluids. I'm talking particularly about plasma chemistry because that's what we routinely look at when we're looking at our blood gas results. Now, I think in terms of understanding Stuart and what brings a lot of ideas together is, in fact, the so-called gamblegrams invented by Gamble in the mid-20th century to describe plasma chemistry but includes in the diagram the concept of electron neutrality. That is, you can't have an excess of positive or negative ions in a solution like plasma overall at the macro level. Dr. Kenny talks about the micro level and what may be happening around plasma membranes. That is a different topic. We as critical care physicians are particularly interested in what's directly happening in the plasma. The bicarbonate-based approaches will give you a qualitative value of what is the acid-base diagnosis. If you go the next step and say, why is this happening? The standard Henderson-Hasselbalch equation only gives you very limited information, if any. And then if you then move on to things such as the anion gap, that is actually moving more and more towards the Stuart approach.
Exactly.
And in fact, the people who are the experts in things such as the anion gap are now suggesting that, in fact, you would use a correction of albumin that is identical to the Stuart value of albumin, change in albumin, to calculate your anion gap.
Hey, listeners, what Dr. Story just spoke about is a perfect encapsulation of how I feel about acid-base. And in fact, I'm going to stop calling myself, at least on these podcasts, a Stuartite or someone advocating the Stuart approach, because it just opens folks up to discarding the clinical approach to bedside acid-base that I feel really is helpful. So what I'm going to say from now on is, I don't care whether you like Henderson-Hasselbalch or Stuart or any other system, you need to have a quantitative, not a semi-quantitative, not a qualitative, a quantitative approach to acid-base. And I've said it before on these acid-base podcasts, and I'll say it again. If you are a Henderson-Hasselbalch person who is correcting your anion gap for albumin, and you're actually looking at what we would call strong ions in the Stuart approach, but non-anion gap metabolic acidosis in a quantitative fashion, whether that means doing a delta gap, or I think the far superior method is just looking at the sodium chloride difference, and you could do that despite being a Henderson-Hasselbalch person, and you're actually trying to fill your corrected anion gap with the other measurable anions, like lactate, like beta-hydroxybutyrate, if you're doing that math work, regardless of your approach, it will turn out exactly the same. And if you don't want to use base excess or base deficit, you could just use bicarb and achieve the exact same stuff. 24 minus the patient's bicarb is your base deficit. It's the same thing. If you're correcting for albumin, whether with that 24 minus bicarb or with your anion gap, and you're trying to fill that gap, and you're accounting for your strong ion difference, you are doing quantitative acid base in a way that, to my mind, is exactly the same as the Stuart approach. And I think it's inarguable that this makes sense to do, to actually know not just the trend, but the actual amount of the various acid-base abnormalities your patient has. And then, of course, in both approaches, you're doing the compensatory work to look at, are they adequately compensating based on the opposite of their primary disorder? That's built into both of them, so it's not worth commenting on too much. I think if you have someone that doesn't believe what I just said, then have them look at the gamblegram, just like Dr. Story mentioned. I have a gamblegram in the post. It's also on the previous acid-base post. If you look at that and understand it and believe in the concept that there must be neutrality at a plasma level, then the quantitative approach becomes, I think, an inarguable conclusion. You can't look at that, understand what it actually means, understand the ramifications that has on acid base, and then not go further and say, huh, if I get this, it makes logical sense to then do a quantitative approach to acid base. All right, I'm going to get off my soapbox. I don't want to take too much of your time on this because I've talked about it in other places, but that's how I feel. Now, let's go a little further on the lactate side. Now, Paul Marek has extensively and comprehensively stated that lactate does not cause a metabolic acidosis. And I think there's some conflation of the intracellular versus plasma, but I'd love to hear your take on this because I find it baffling every time he says it. And John Emile Kenney's post seemed to deal with the same thing. I don't have an understanding nor a necessity to know what's going on with lactate at the intracellular level. At the plasma level, it is, I believe, not really up for debate that lactate causes acidosis. What do you think?
From a pure plasma chemistry point of view, one of the strengths of the Stewart approach is that you can say, if the plasma lactate has increased, and in physiological pH, lactate is a strong ion that is almost completely dissociated, you have a reduction in your strong ion difference, you have an acidosis. So if you give a patient a solution, what you would call Ringer's lactate, what we would call Hartmann's solution, if you give reasonable volumes of that to a patient, you do get an increase in the lactate, particularly in patients who have reduced hepatic clearance. You will get a metabolic acidosis initially associated with the presence of that lactate. As the lactate is removed from the circulation by the Corey cycle in the liver and other tissues, then the lactate will fall and you'll therefore have a degree of alkalosis associated with the removal of lactate. And in fact, if you look at a bag of Hartmann's, it says lactate. I'm not sure whether this Ringer's lactate says the same thing, but on Hartmann's solution that we use, which is very similar to Ringer's lactate, it says bicarbonate as lactate. So, you know, it is well recognized these solutions, ultimately, when the lactate is removed from the plasma, you get a metabolic alkalosis. So, but, you know, there's arguments about, you know, metabolic source of bicarbonate. In the Stewart approach, you don't have to think about that. You can simply say, right, this patient had lactate in their circulation. That has now been removed. You have a resolving lactate-associated acidosis, or if you like, in the reverse, you have an alkalosis. Similarly, if you have a patient who is unwell and their lactate level drops down because they're being adequately treated, you will get a resolving metabolic acidosis from the removal of that lactate. So my point of view is 100% lactate does cause acidosis. In the Stewart approach, it's incredibly easy to explain. Similarly, if you give someone a large volume of sodium chloride, why does that produce a metabolic acidosis? Because you've increased the plasma chloride. That's it. You don't have to argue about anything else. You don't have to argue about dilution of bicarbonate or whatever. That's the cause. And I think as a critical care physician, I find that part of Stewart particularly attractive. I can directly, without any fuss, without any metabolism, explain exactly why my therapies are changing the plasma chemistry of my patient.
Let me ask you this one. Very often in a profoundly critically ill patient, we'll actually get a negative SIG, and we'll look for things that are easy, like lithium, and they don't have multiple myeloma. What is causing these excess non-measured cations?
There's two components. One of the problems with the SIG is that you've got so many variables that it adds up with machine error. So you run the risk of having multiple errors. So if I saw a positive SIG, my first thought would be, in fact, you know, we've just got too many variables. And this is one of my concerns with the SIG. I think it is a useful idea. My personal view is it should be called net unmeasured ions. The problem with the strong ion gap or SIG is that the gap itself, that is, if you like, the boundaries of the gap are not all strong ions. It's both strong ions and the weak acids. And what's in the middle, what's in the gap, is also probably a combination of strong ions and weak acids. And it will depend on the individual, particularly in a wide SIG. If you get a positive SIG, my first thought is this is cumulative, you know, error sort of adding up in the wrong direction. But then it is also very clear that there are a lot of known unknowns in plasma chemistry, particularly in the critically ill. I wrote an editorial about 10 years ago. I know John Kellum, in particular, has looked for many years at this particular area, as being as one of the people who came up with the concept of the SIG, that, you know, there's a lot in the gap and we don't know what it is. And similarly, I think the other possibility with the positive may lie in protein-associated weak acids. That would be the other area where you have, you know, various sort of changes in amino acids in the plasma for whatever reason, that may be another explanation of a positive SIG.
What is the major error you see at the bedside in critical care or in the ORs that just really makes you angry in terms of acid base?
As an anesthesiologist, I mean, the first is, you know, inappropriate management of ventilation, particularly in patients who are critically ill, and where you see an unnecessary mixed disorder because someone hasn't thought hard enough about the pH. I mean, no matter what we talk about, ultimately it's the pH that counts.
Oh, yeah, that's such a good one. And it gets even worse, I think, when there's a lack of appreciation of the need to actually put a patient on mechanical ventilation solely due to their acid-base status. The patient's maintaining an airway, their sats are good, but some patients just need to be intubated in order to blow off carbon dioxide to compensate. And I think, at least in emergency medicine, that's an often unrecognized indication for mechanical ventilation. But let's get back to the idea of it's the pH that counts. I find a very different physiologic milieu in a DKA patient with a pH of 6.8 and a septic patient with a pH of 6.8. And it seems like the DKA patients tolerate that phenomenon very well. The septic patients want to die very quickly. So, and why does there seem to be a real variability in the tolerance of these pHs given the actual condition they're suffering?
Acid-base disorders are seen with a whole lot of different disorders. And one of the things that strikes me, particularly as someone who does liver transplants, is in some ways I think plasma chemistry is a bit like astronomy, that we can look at distant stars and make assumptions about what's happening in the stars. Similarly with our plasma chemistry, we can make assumptions about what's happening intracellularly. But I'm very confident that my patient in front of me who's got, you know, severe end-stage cirrhosis undergoing liver transplantation has widespread metabolic mayhem, you know, that, or probably almost of indescribable levels. And sometimes the patients who are really sick and the mayhem overwhelms them die on the table, which is, you know, rare. But that is what I've sort of thought about, particularly patients who just gradually become more supportable. And I think if you, and that is the fundamental answer to your question, I think, is what is the difference in the intracellular mayhem of a patient with ketoacidosis versus a patient with sepsis? And I think that is where the fundamental difference lies, that your patient with ketoacidosis probably has a degree of relatively straightforward cellular or metabolic dysfunction, whereas the patient with sepsis has widespread, you know, rampant metabolic mayhem in their cells. And they both may have quite similar pH, but the underlying cause and the severity of the metabolic injury is less in the patient with DKA. That would be how I'd view it.
All right, that makes complete sense. So while we're looking at the pH of the plasma, it represents very different things in a patient with a disease state such as sepsis, where there's intracellular mayhem, and that 7.0 represents a horrible metabolic situation inside the cell versus 7.0 in a DKA patient, which is pretty much a phenomenon of cellular integrity. It's just extra cellular problems with sugar metabolism. This makes sense. Hopefully this whole episode makes sense, but if it doesn't, then comment at mcrit.org. That's the best place to put the comments up. A lot of people send me emails. There's no patient protected information in there. Share it with the group. Come on, folks. Put it up in the comments section. So how do we sum this up? Bicar ICU probably has pushed me over the edge of patients with critical illness and renal failure to give bicarb infusions, not bicarb pushes, bicarb infusions, to get their pH up a little bit. John Emil Kenny's posts are dealing with stuff that I don't understand and don't deal with on my regular clinical practice. Here's what I know. A quantitative approach makes more sense. There's just no reason not to be doing it, whether you do it from the perspective of Henderson, Hasselbach, or Stewart. The title of these two posts was The Great Lactate Debate. All of that debate is what's going on a intracellular proton counting level. Again, it does not matter to my clinical practice. What I think there's no debate about, unless someone could show me some compelling evidence, is that if you have lactate in your plasma that's not metabolized, you are in the midst of a metabolic acidosis. This is, I think, indisputable. And so I wish my friend Paul would stop saying that lactate doesn't cause acidosis, or at least clarify he means intracellularly, because in the plasma, it does. If your lactate is 5, I promise you, you have an acidosis. And your pH may be low or it may be normal, but that's because other things are compensating for it. You definitely have a component of non-ion gap metabolic acidosis from your lactate of 5. There's no possible way you could tell me otherwise without some compelling evidence on the plasma level. And I'll wait for it. But until then, please, please stop saying this. Okay. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.